Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Pulley.
And I'm Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for March 4th, 2026.
All right. Scott, before I jump into my first one, I just kind of figured, you know, point in time and everything, we should maybe make a quick mention, just kind of, you know, what this atmosphere looks like. So with the regional conflicts with U.S., Israel, and Iran right now, similar to, you know, the Russian-Ukraine conflict just a couple years back, people in our field tend to have to spin up and be hot on the wire for different things that happen. So I thought maybe bringing it up right at the beginning of the show today, just to kind of like help maybe center some folks that are going to be in that kind of stress situation, understand that these positions always create a lot of noise a lot of times, but also create a good avenue to help refocus and recenter on a lot of the basics. There's going to be a ton that's going to probably occur around this. At least I would expect that. I'm assuming you would too. But yeah, just, you know, kind of talking to listeners, you know, think about, you know, the different areas that could be affected. Understand your environments, like we always talk about. You know, if you'd be a target of given things, and then, you know, one of the things that I think I echo in times like this, and I'm assuming you will too, Scott, but back to those basic things, you know, understand those behavioral type things that kind of help you stretch across many potential avenues, actor groups that are in play, like we've seen with the Russia-Ukraine side, where we've seen different actor groups, you know, targeting different things, but using some of those similar behaviors, those persistence behaviors, those obfuscation behaviors, things like that, just kind of recenter on those to help give yourself a bit of shoring up. But yeah, you know, I just thought it was worth at least bringing up at the top of the show, just to make sure that point in time people are considering stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, we saw a conflict with the Russia-Ukraine stuff. And one thing that when you pay attention to it over time, there's a lot to learn from it because a lot more seems to hit the surface. So it's good kind of like being aware because there's stuff that you may learn that you may not have known through some of the activities that may occur. But also kind of like you're saying, like staying true to the basics, paying attention to the really common behaviors that you're typically looking for, just because speed becomes a bigger factor in conflicts. So there might be a more rush to get things done, which means not really advanced or very never seen before type techniques may also occur. Even if there's something unseen, like a 0 day to get into an environment. Once in an environment, there may be some really basic stuff just to be quick. So just be thinking about problems in that fashion to not overstress out, but also take advantage of the opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So diving into our weekly updates here, I'm gonna kick it off this week, Scott, with an article from Arctic Wolf. So this article is titled Sloppy Lemming deploys burrow shell and rust-based rat to target Pakistan and Bangladesh. So the Indian Nexus threat actor Sloppy Lemming, they're also tracked elsewhere as Outrider Tiger and Fishing Elephant. They conducted a sustained campaign over the past year targeting government and critical infrastructure entities in Pakistan and Bangladesh. The campaign used two separate infection paths. One delivered a custom backdoor called Burrow Shell, and another deploying that rust-based rat/keylogger, kind of showing a bit of diversification and tooling there. Victims included nuclear oversight bodies, telecommunication operators, defense logistics organizations, energy utilities, and so on, aligning with a bit of intelligent collection objectives focused on South Asia. Researchers identified 112 Cloudflare worker domains used as the campaign infrastructure, a significant increase from reporting for this that had occurred earlier, really kind of suggesting or showing a bit of that scaling of operations. And the actor abused legitimate Microsoft binaries, DLLCI loading techniques to execute all of the malicious loaders, you know, really trying to appear as legitimate tooling. So kind of walking through a bit of the technical pieces here. So I'm going to talk about two of the behavior chains. First, we're going to start with Burrow Shell. Victims would receive a spear phishing email containing a PDF decoy document that had a blurred page and a social engineering prompt encouraging download of the full document. the lure redirects to the click once application manifest, which triggers download of a staged application package. And the package includes a legitimate Microsoft.NET runtime binary and engine task.exe and a malicious loader, DLL, enabling execution through DLL search order hijacking. The loader, or the malicious DLL, you know, decrypts and launches a custom X64 shellcode backdoor called Burl Shell, and it puts it directly into memory. And then Burl Shell provides file manipulation, screenshot capture, remote command execution, SOX proxy tunneling, and so on. The communications actually for the C2 side actually were driven to mimic Windows update network traffic, and were in RC4 encrypted with a 32 character key. So the second behavior here was for that Rust Rat. It's an alternate spear phishing attachment that included macro-enabled Excel spreadsheets. So the macros would download and execute that Rust-based keyloader or keylogger in RAT. And the Rust implant includes keylogging, plus network recon features like port scanning and network enumeration. Some additional details here across all. The campaign infrastructure heavily relied on those worker domains, those Cloudflare worker domains, and they were used to impersonate government institutions. The stage payload infrastructure included the Havoc C2 framework loaders and previously associated tooling. So you have your Cobalt Strike usage and then another tooling called NecroWire. And the domain registrations, this is part of that earlier mentioned kind of uptick on scaling. The domain registrations had surged around mid last year, around July of last year, kind of giving information to that suggestion of intensified campaign uptick. So there's a ton here, Scott. I'm gonna stop short of diving into each of the DLL side loading aspects of this. But short and sweet on this one, it is interesting with a handful of the things that occurred here. Some of the stuff that I kind of tracked right off the top as I was going through this one for things that we might be able to consider to haunt or detect this kind of activity. So one that stands out, and we don't actually talk about this one too often, but we did, I think it was last our last show or one of the shows before where macros came back into play, right? So yeah. Again, we see that kind of here, another instance of that, but really tracking those Microsoft Office applications, kind of spawning unusual processes, right? So kicking off things like your PowerShells, command line, C script, W script, things like that. That's kind of low hanging fruit to really check. And you see that in this area. You could try to get creative and go after identifying some of the suspicious bucketing of this Cloudflare worker domains that are being sought after. Although I would imagine that would be a little complicated depending on your environment, of course. Looking for that kind of traffic that's masquerading as Windows update, but really kind of, potentially originating from an unusual process or maybe an unusual endpoint. So just a few takeaways I kind of had with that one, but I'm going to stop on this one because I know my second article is going to have a lot more time spent, and see what you think, Scott.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing here is looking at a lot of the DLL side loading approaches. We've talked about it before. It's really good to pay attention to when you see DLL file writes, especially with exe file writes within the same directory in short periods of time. So if you have that telemetry, it can be really strong for someone trying to use this technique, unless they spread it out over a really long period of time, which isn't usually how it's done. But it's also, even looking at the macro piece, right, they go and fetch what looks like a favicon icon and save it as a DLL, and then they fetch would be from the URL path a PDF and then save it as the exe. Either way, if you have telemetry, not only telemetry for the specific file writes, but if you can associate it like contextually with a process, that can be a huge win as well, because it is always interesting to pay attention to when you have like a script interpreter like WScript, command prompt, PowerShell creating files and the types of files. At least for that attack vector that they're using from the macro side, that would be probably extremely obvious. Obviously, it's interesting that they're using Havoc, because one of the things I found today as well is leveraging Havoc So it seems like Havoc's kind of in play, at least as a low-hanging C2 framework that actors may be using. And this could be directly associated with what we talked about earlier. There's a need for speed potentially on certain campaigns now. So the old tried and true techniques or tools may kind of resurface or be utilized again. So it's good to pay attention to that. But yeah, the DLL side loading thing is the biggest key piece to walk away from here. They have multiple attack vectors, but seem to always need DLL side loading for execution. And I think that's kind of common with some of the, from what I've seen, just the past two articles, right, for the Havoc execution, based on how those agents are built.
Yeah, for sure. And then, to the point, leaving this one to, because we talk about it so often, but we see the common persistence approach here, just setting that run register key. So, again, as echoed in like our kind of intro here when we were talking about the conflict, like it's just those common behaviors that are always going to circulate. So it's really good to anchor on them, and we see it again here. We'll see it again probably in other ones we go through today. All right, Scott, what do you got next for us?
So yeah, the next one is it's a Huntress blog, right? And it's titled "Exorcising Demons: Fake Tech Support Delivers Havoc Command and Control." Basically, it looks like the typical. Now you see a lot more vishing, as initial vectors because you bypass a lot of controls if you can get right to the person. So that like perimeter, fortress isn't as useful in this case, but basically they present themselves as an IT support that gets you or convince you to download an RMM tool, and I think they mentioned one in particular, but they said that it wasn't necessarily specific to just one RMM tool. But either way, the idea is, and the user can see what the fake IT support person is doing and how they move their payload. They actually have a web page that looks like a Microsoft branded Outlook anti-spam panel because they're saying they need to patch something real quick. Like that's the point, right? So then they do the anti-spam, which actually moves the payloads that are needed into the environment and set up basically the Havoc C2 infrastructure. Now, some of the interesting things that I kind of noticed in the article, obviously paying attention to any kind of installation with RMM tools, remote management tools, they all have kind of different behaviors as far as what kind of how many files they write, where they usually write to, do they set up a service, all that kind of stuff. And the other thing that, is interesting, it goes through a lot of, because they said they modified some of the Havoc agents and kind of how that process and stuff went. And what was interesting is they did do DLL side loading, but in this case, they did some reflection and or forwarding, which is interesting because in this case, they had the vulnerable services, right, that are vulnerable to search order hijacking for DLL side loading. And it had just the code it needed to run, but any of the function calls to actually were legitimate functions that the program needed to use, it just forwarded those to the legitimate DLL that was also existing in the same directory. So basically, they didn't have to worry about, breaking the functionality of what they were side loading. They just basically were able to kind of add to or stand in the middle so they can make sure everything worked correctly, which is, I think, not as commonly seen with a lot of the DLL siloing approaches because I think they were DLL siloing like system-based processes. So obviously, if you break something on the system, you create instability. I think that was their way. So there's some sophistication associated with this. And they even went as far as using, process injection. But what's interesting about process injection is, a lot of EDR tools, for instance, will pay attention to like the virtual alloc for like, creating space, allocating memory space, and then starting a process suspended, and then, like all that kind of stuff. So they actually leveraged both Hell's Gate and Halo's Gate, which is kind of an old technique, but the idea there is, when you're suspending a process or starting something suspended and allocating memory space, you're using Windows APIs, and that's how the EDRs can see like those APIs being used, because the way they hook everything. Well, the APIs being leveraged actually live in the NTDLL DLL, which is like holds a lot of the system-based APIs for Windows. But Hell's Gate, what's interesting about it is instead of actually trying to call the APIs directly, they actually use the export address table and they resolve the functional addresses in order to actually extract the system service numbers, SSNs, which allows them to basically do direct syscall to those APIs without calling them, because they can call basically the memory address and execute them that way. And it's funny because the Halo's Gate was actually created because EDRs were looking for the APIs used to try to find those specific, like doing that method. And Halo's Gate basically is another method. Instead of searching for like the specific syscalls you want, you search for adjacent ones. And then based on mathematically how you know the sizing of those, the code for the memory objects, you can kind of infer, oh, this is probably the one I want, and then call it that way. Which is just kind of, you know, really tricky, right? When you're like getting down to like almost the memory bit level in a sense. So that's something they leverage as well. And the other thing that I thought was interesting is anytime they ran their process to protect it, there is a API in Windows called Detours, and it's usually for use by developers, but basically it enables you to say, hey, I'm going to hook this thing so that when this API goes to run, it will run whatever code I hook with the Detours API, and then when it'll run my code and then run itself. In this case, they use Detours to basically run their own code, which created like a sleep instance, right? But it was on a loop. So basically their code would never exit. So therefore the process would never hit the API to actually kill it. So a way for preventing kind of EDRs or other things trying to kill their process. So it sounds really sophisticated, right? Well, there's some things to take note here. One is when they got in, they quickly laterally moved to 9 machines. They had kind of their script, hands-on keyboard playbooks kind of already written out, which it's good in some aspects because that means it's probably very repeatable and will be repeated. But in one of the bat scripts that they drop, and they're dropping these in the software distribution down, like Windows software distribution downloads directory, the bat runs, it actually runs type. And what's interesting about type is it's basically grabbing every single file downloaded or moved there and basically pushing it all into a cab file. So type sometimes can be used to actually merge files, and that's essentially what it's doing. So it's basically constructing that cab file, then it deletes all those cab files. So type is an executable by itself, so you should see that activity. Then they do an expand on the cab, which is its own executable, which is basically opening up the cab. Then it deletes that. And then those are really the DLL payloads that it's basically using for the Havoc piece. So that's kind of like the construction of the agents and the DLLs and everything when they get moved. So also a very interesting series of techniques to not be picked up by tooling, but easily picked up by, you know, data and understanding those behaviors. The RMM service that was commonly used here was Level RMM, which I'm actually not familiar with that one. But like I said, they all have unique characteristics. And in this case, it creates a service, and the service actually calls Level, right, which is the exe. But the argument it uses, it passes a key that kind of looks like your, you know, base64 type encoded scramble. But, you know, just knowing that you can see --key, most times you wouldn't have keys, I would say, as part of the binary path or executions for, you know, security purposes. So if you see them, that could be something that maybe you don't want exposed. Or if you see them, it means that maybe someone's doing something like this. So these are some just interesting things. Even though there's some sophistication with this type of attack, there are notable things that make it easily identifiable, at least on parts and pieces of this as well. So yeah, I don't know what you thought, because it was kind of a lot technical going on there.
Oh yeah, it's brain burner. But no, there was another part. If I I don't think I'm going to repeat what you had said on this one. I don't think you had mentioned this one specifically, but I thought it was pretty cool. The Havoc source code is sitting in a what's called a daemon agent. So that agent, this is a part I thought was kind of interesting, Scott, and definitely worth talking about relative to the Havoc piece.
Mm-hmm.
That agent reads three registry values at runtime.
Right.
And all three use the same two registry paths with a HKCU primary and an HKLM fallback. So it's the HKCU, the primary is a software classes, local settings, software, Microsoft value. And then the fallback is the software Microsoft SQM client. So why this matters? The three registry values each serve a distinct purpose, and I'm reading directly from the article, so I'm clear on this. The UXMP likely stores the file path to the daemon payload on disk. So when the agent needs to perform a fork and run operation, it reads this path, creates a randomly named pipe, and calls the create process W to spawn a sacrificial process for executing post-exploitation tasks. What's cool about this, what I thought was interesting about this is how they call out that the registry-based C2 recovery mechanism isn't a stock part of Havoc. So there's been some modifications to how they're using using that. In the default framework for Havoc, those C2 URLs are kind of baked into the configuration when it's compiled, and there's no real registry fallback. But this modification, as they pointed out in the article, really gives you a bit of that extra resilience layer. So you can recover a fresh set of C2 addresses from the registry without having to redeploy anything or recompile, which is pretty neat. But yeah, that's just one thing that stood out to me there, Scott. Also, one of the other parts too, I thought, I love seeing the kind of creative, the little nuances. I don't know why these always stand out to me, but the little nuances of how they consider trying to hide what they do. I'm trying to find the blurb. I scrolled past it a bit, but they had this, basically this call out because they used that splash page to make it look like a Windows update.
Uh-huh.
And they actually made sure that they added text within the finish of that code run where it actually will echo or deploy that the Windows update's finished. It's kind of interesting.
Oh yeah.
A small little touch to make the end user feel more comfortable about being compromised.
Right. I mean, like it really is the end user game. As long as you don't get them to squawk, you buy yourself a lot of time, right? And once you make them feel something's fishy, that's all it takes to kind of blow your cover.
Yep. Well, very cool.
Cool. What do you got for us next then?
All right. Next one from me is an article from Socket. It's titled Stega Bin, 26 Malicious NPM Packages Use Pastebin Steganography to Deploy Multi-Stage Credential Stealer. So yeah, hey, found myself back to some supply chain level NPM type stuff, Scott.
Right.
Who'd have thought? Researchers uncovered 26 malicious NPM packages published over a 2-day period that target developers through the JavaScript ecosystem, delivering a multi-stage credential stealing malware operation. The activity is linked to the North Korean Contagious Interview campaign and associated with Famous Kalima and Lazarus ecosystem, which frequently targets developer environments, especially as of late, mainly for credential theft and then supply chain access, of course. So the campaign is dubbed Stegabin. It hides command and control infrastructure using character level steganography embedded in pastebin posts, kind of functioning as a dead drop resolver. Once installed, the packages deploy across platform RAT and a nine module info stealer toolkit. That's a run on words there. It's designed to harvest developer secrets, including SSH keys, Git repositories, browser credentials, environment tokens, and more. The operation kind of demonstrates more to that, you know, software supply chain compromise directly going after the developer workstation, something me and you both predicted is going to continue on as we go forward because it's been successful. You know, really enabling those attackers to pivot into CI/CD systems and further in the enterprise environments. So some of the technical pieces around this, a little lengthy, so please bear with me. The attackers published the 26 typosquatted NPM packages masquerading as common developer utilities across the NPM registry. The packages include a shared malicious loader file located at the vendor/scrypt-js version.js, which triggers the initial infection chain. So the part here where it gets kind of really interesting is the steganography dead drop piece. So the loader retrieves pastebin pages containing benign looking text, usually, or what they've referenced in here is it's like computer science essays, as one example. Characters at specific intervals are extracted to decode the hidden C2 URLs that are embedded through that steganography. So the decoder strips zero width Unicode characters. It'll read a 5-digit length marker from the beginning. It calculates evenly spaced character positions throughout the text and extracts those characters at those positions. The extracted characters are then split on a 3-pipe separator with a end termination marker to produce an array of C2 domains. So the decoded infrastructure points to 31 attacker-controlled versal deployments, providing resilient routing for additional payload delivery. The resolved infrastructure delivers platform-specific shell payloads that bootstrap further malware stages. So the malware actually will iterate over that decoded domain list and fetch platform-specific payloads. So they give examples in the article of what the curl wget usages are for Mac, Linux, and Windows. And at the time of analysis, only the first domain returned a live response. They also mentioned that non-curl user agents would receive a decoy response that would give them a permanently suspended message. So very, very, very interesting there. The RAT deployment. So this part is the final stage. It installs a remote access Trojan and a WebSocket style control capability with command execution functionality. So this is where that 9-module InfoStealer toolkit is installed. So the modules that are deployed by this RAT focus specifically on that developer environment, specifically going after the secrets. So it'll look for things like the VS Code configuration and tokens, your private SSH keys, your Git repo and credentials, browser credential stores, clipboard data and local secrets, crypto wallets, and then some automated scanning for exposed secrets to those repositories. As part of that secret search, and this one was interesting to see, just for me, because it seems to be being leveraged more, especially in these focused attacks. But as part of that search and grab, one of the modules that this RAT actually pulls down is a legitimate TruffleHog binary. TruffleHog is a secret stealing tool that's specifically used to kind of detect those API keys, credential stores, and more. So definitely a fingerprint at a minimum. But those modules actively harvest, collect sensitive data, artifacts, and credentials. So this one's, I thought, was really cool. The leveraging the JavaScript loader to conceal payload resolution and decode routines. This is something that has been continuing to happen. The steganography piece stood out to me. I thought it was pretty interesting, kind of how they did these multi-stage effects to actually set up their whole infrastructure. The kind of that dead drop resolver design, it seems like it helps reduce the static indicators and really complicates that, you know, trying to block their infrastructure. And because they're staging with those versal deployments, it's basically serverless. It's really easy to stand up and spin up new servers. And it really kind of helps like blend malicious traffic with legitimate application traffic, because versals are used pretty much all over the place. So some of the hunt detection stuff that I kind of keyed on here. So the general attack chain, like real simple top-down attack chain, it's like 5 steps. You know, you have your NPM install where node process executes that kind of unusual JavaScript loader. Then you have a call to pastebin. You have a pastebin HTTP request. Then you see a connection to that, to the, you know, whatever the setup to .virtual.app, and then downloaded script followed with the execution. So you kind of see this really simple chain that I think, in a lot of ways, from just a raw hunting perspective, is a good thing to consider or chase down. You know, the other pieces are, you know, kind of checking for those NPM packages, executing post-install scripts that kind of falls in the line of understanding your environment, especially your developer environment. If you can, source code scanning. The network piece is kind of tied to that chain piece that I think, you know, looking for those pastebin calls followed by immediate connections to those versal .app sites. And then also the another piece that, again, is low-hanging fruit. So watching for Truffle Hog usage. This one's easy. Anything accessing or directly, like a suspicious process interacting with your, you know, your Git config files, your browser credential stores, your VS Code configuration paths, your SSH directories, things like that are happening here. So definitely other things to go after. But there was a lot. I just found this one really interesting, Scott. I think the supply chain stuff's fantastic. There's a lot of meat and potatoes in this one, stuff that we can actually go and do stuff with. So thought it was cool. Curious what you think.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, it's, I think what I really like is it shows the attack across the three different operating systems, right? So you can kind of compare and contrast, like, how actors may differ and where things may be aligned or similar. So that's always kind of fun to look at. Obviously, when you're installing, like, packages like NPM and stuff, like, there's compatibility there. So it's much easier to just kind of, like, attack different instances. But all the follow-on activity looks slightly different sometimes because you're using other bins potentially. Or executables that, you know, don't exist everywhere. It's interesting that Pastebin was leveraged because I just remember, like, Pastebin was a big worry, you know, early when people were exfilling data to Pastebin. So people really started paying more attention to just Pastebin activity in general. And I'm just kind of curious if they still are. Because in this instance, it looks like, you know, they're expecting there to be access to Pastebin or no one's going to be monitoring that. The other is the platform specific shell payloads where they either do a curl or wget and then pipe that to basically bash or command prompt. One thing to note when it comes to commands and pipes, a lot of times the pipe kind of cuts off in the command line logging where the logging stops. So you'll often not see that as one big, like, oh, I just need to look for this and this. Like, be wary of that. That's why it's good to test how your logging reacts to different structures of command line. But if you're able to, it's very valuable to look at process execution timing, right? So when you see... If you can also assert order as well as timing, when you see curl and then bin bash launching, or you see wget and then bin bash launching, sometimes that's a good tell that they might be related. So paying attention to that, just because in most environments, I don't expect that to happen that often, especially you can make a pretty tight window there usually. So that's something to pay attention to. And then the other thing I thought was really interesting was the white space trick, right? Where they're basically, anytime they're going to launch something, they inserted 186 basically space characters before the command, which isn't going to affect how the command runs, but it does affect how it can be seen. In most logging, 186 spaces doesn't really affect whether it gets logged because it can go thousands, right, of characters, especially with Windows and Sysmon. And Sysmon, I think, could even be more verbose, but so I was trying to wrap my head around why 186, and it came more down to, well, if you're forwarding the logs to another tool that may truncate logging, because, you know, for instance, if you have a system that is collecting, you know, thousands upon thousands of events a minute, they sometimes will truncate messages so that they can keep up with processing time. So there's a chance it could get truncated at that instance. Or if there's a GUI or visual view of when you, like, click to look at alerts or logging, it might not just be visible even though it's there in the raw data. So another way to, like, prevent interaction that way. So it's kind of like attacking the analysts or analyst tool sets, like how they interact potentially. So I thought that was a interesting add because it's not preventing the logging per se, but it is preventing, like, the discovery to some degree, depending on what's being leveraged. So that is very interesting, just from, like, what's the approach. And then the last thing was the call to, there's a lot of data that once they, you know, discover things or collect things, being shipped directly to an IP address via HTTP. So, you know, unencrypted web protocol direct to an IP, always suspicious, worth taking note of. So those are some, I think, easy wins to try to pay attention to there.
Yeah, that's all good points, man. The one thing I'm curious on, I was trying to side see if I could get some information really quick, but nothing concrete. But I wonder, because I remember the Paceman stuff just always being kind of a hot topic. And I wonder, because of the method here, that it's, you know, using a get versus a post, that maybe that finds itself out of that net that was cast in previous years for Paceman, because it was typically worried about exfilling too, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's, at least from what I remember, right?
Uh-huh.
So if it is that, it's you know, it's creative.
Right.
All right, Scott, what's last for this week?
So kind of a meaty one, so I'm not going to try to get into too much of the weeds because there is a lot here, but it's just it's a Zscaler blog, and they're talking about APT37 and saying it adds new capabilities for air gap networks. I kind of just picked this one up because it's always interesting when we talk about, like, not so much like what is attacking air gap networks, but like what is the methodology, right, and the amount of work or thought that goes into that. So basically in December, the Zscaler Threat Labs, they discovered a campaign that was linked to APT37, also known as Scarcruft, Ruby Sleeper, Velvet, Kolima, right? But it's North Korean backed group, well known for stuff like that. But what's interesting is it kind of starts with just the Windows shortcut LNK file that initiates the attack. That sets off a whole set of tools they use for different purposes. And the tools listed are RESTLEAF, which I think is known, but they use that here, SnakeDropper, ThumbsBD, or ThumbSBD, however you want to say that, and then VirusTask, FootWine, and BlueLight. And so basically they were targeting government-related entities to steal sensitive data. But, you know, obviously entities that are going to have air gap networks to begin with. And they're using in-memory Windows-based malware. And they actually use a lot of Ruby, which I thought was just interesting. And so that, you know, when you have to bring a whole, like, language to a system that doesn't by default know it, you kind of have to have the environment in order for it to run in. So, you know, they had to move those pieces in, which I thought was interesting because typically, you know, already out of the gate, if I'm not using Ruby or, you know, scripting languages like that, those might be just good detections to be looking for file creates just on languages we don't use. That would be a good, you know, approach here. Basically the first stage is initial vector is a Windows shortcut LNK that's basically shared. It's going to kick off PowerShell. But then the first stage is there's a downloader that's called RESTLEAF. Then there's a second stage delivery that's known as SnakeDropper, which is there able to drop a bunch of other things. Which then gets to the ThumbsBD and VirusTask, which deal with the USB component because that's how they want to move. I mean, that's typically how you get into air gap networks is removable media that has to go back and forth and move things or whatever. They had some like BlueLight and FootWine, which are their surveillance kind of malware pieces. And then their command and control, which they use a lot of cloud infrastructure for how they, you know, do all of that. But some of the key things to look at and pay attention to, obviously, you've got PowerShell script that's being launched by that LNK, and its purpose is to carve multiple embedded payloads from fixed offsets. Now, I don't remember the exact calls, but there's like two ways typically, but I'm pretty sure most people use like the system, like IO type method, where they're calling the .NET objects specifically, not commandlets. That are usually associated with carving things with PowerShell. So they didn't provide an example, but that's kind of the way I would go of, hey, how would I identify at least that kind of behavior of carving things? Because that's not typical in any fashion. So if you find any good documentation that's dealing with carving files with PowerShell, it's worth building some sort of behavioral thing about it. And then, you know, if you can find a few different ways, then you feel like you're covering down on most what people would do. But that's kind of how the initial payload kind of works. And then the cloud storage that they're using for C2 from that perspective is the Zoho work drive, which I think is newer for them based on what they reported in the article. And then they, you know, that brings in SnakeDropper, which needs a Ruby interpreter. And so it also, as part of one of the things it does, is it creates some directories the kind of store data. It makes this big call out to USB speed for everything as if like that's going to be, you know, not as obvious essentially. But one of the key things to pay attention to here is they do create a scheduled task, you know, going back to the USB Speed EXE that it creates every 5 minutes. So paying attention to just tasks that get created that aren't consistent with tasks in the rest of your environment is always a big key indicator that compares and contrasts there. So like rarity becomes a big example. Especially if you can tell something's like spawned from services and it's not being spawned anywhere else, that means it's kind of a task that's already there that maybe you didn't see the creation of, kind of worth looking into. But that's snake dropper is really meant to drop the other things, like I mentioned. So then you've got thumbs BD, which is its big purpose is to basically do the enumeration of everything. So they mentioned a couple things in here, and I'm sure if people are familiar with the common bins for Windows discovery, they could probably figure out the rest. But basically, when that malware gets on to a USB, when it's inserted within an environment, it tries to run DXDiag, which pulls out some system specific, like hardware specific things. They get enumerating all the running processes. It's probably using something like task lists and so forth. Some network configuration with the IP config, does some recursive file system enumeration, I don't know what it's using specifically for that, but it's basically, they said it can complete a file tree. So kind of like a, how everything's stored visually, essentially. But it might do it just based on pass and then show the list of things. And then it does like connectivity statuses, right? Via ping test and netstat. And the reason for that is sometimes when, you know, if you're attacking an air gap network, once you're inside the air gap network, you might identify ways you can actually get out of the air gap that, you know, it's air gapped logically, but not really physically. And so then you might identify other attack vectors that you don't have to rely, because any information you collect in an air gap, you're relying on someone to bring that back out at some point to connect it in. And when it does, that data is actually stored in the local app data environment variable directory, at a directory TNGTP and a TN.dat. So it creates a .dat file. So sometimes looking for .dats can be interesting. It's just knowing what is actually creating the file. If you can see the execution again, telemetry back, that's really good. And also on the USB itself, it creates a hidden recycle bin directory, which it's often to see this on any kind of removal directory or removable media. It just comes up. Windows creates it for whatever reason, from time and time again. But that's where it stages its concealed artifacts. The virus task, that's the removal media propagation component. So it's a malware that's purely focused on basically trying to propagate to more removable media and moving all these components. So it, you know, uses the USB speed.exe. It's a legitimate Ruby interpreter, basically. And it hides, what's interesting here is it takes all the victim's files on the movable media, hides them, and then creates LNKs of those same files. So they look identical, but so it's going to force people, if they interact with any of the files, to actually click them. And my guess here that it mentioned is, even though they are hiding it, I'm assuming in the LNK, the target path is executing the malware components as well as opening whatever file they're trying to open. So like it probably has like an ampersand, for instance, to run this and this. So the usual won't know, because their things will still open and work as intended. Then the other thing, they have Footwine, which is, it's an Android package file extension, which is interesting because, you know, it obviously looks like Windows is the target here, but it's really just an encrypted payload with an integrated shellcode launcher. So it basically will launch itself. And that's what includes surveillance features such as a keystroke logging and audio and video capturing. It receives batch script contents from the C2 server when it communicates, and it saves those files in the temp directory with, you know, basically bat files being created with time and date, and executes those. People should be paying attention to bat file creations. Seeing things like that or repeated things like that, you know, obviously adds some interesting aspects as far as, you know, it might be worth paying attention to. And then the blue light component, it's their common backdoor. It's been reported on before, but it basically leverages a lot of legitimate cloud providers for communication for the C2. So you're talking about Google Drive, Microsoft, OneDrive, pCloud, Backblaze, for instance. And so the big thing here, though, you can kind of see from a development perspective, like all the different areas they have to consider to make this work. So it's almost like modularly built, potentially because there might be different challenges with different air gaps that maybe you may need to tweak some things, but some components do work. So building like one monolithic malware to do this would be really painful. But this makes it really easy to figure out how you plug and play with the different code pieces. The only risk I see here from an attacking perspective is you have a lot running, potentially. So there's a lot more potential for some component to be discovered versus if you had one monolithic, basically executable doing one execution to do a bunch of different things behind the scenes. So there's that, but it's just, like I said, I think it's good for people to pay attention to air gap attacks because they are like a little different and they seem more complex, but they're only complex because they got to kind of do things in stages. So what were your thoughts?
Well, first and foremost, Scott, that was incredibly well covered, man. I was like, oh, I got these bolts. I got these. Like, nope. But the one part that you pointed out, I thought I was going to slip in is, and just to echo again, because I thought the piece where it uses, what was it called? Virus task, I think. The part that actually manipulates the removable media drive and replaces the files of the LNK. I was like, yeah, I wondered. You know, I mean, you brought it up, but in my head, the first thing I seen on it, I was like, I wonder if this actually launches the file or just issues the command to deploy the, the compromise. The module piece, there's so many dominoes here for this whole thing right here, but it's really creative. Also, you touched on it at the very beginning. Haven't seen Ruby in a while, man.
I know.
Haven't seen that in quite a bit. Also, like some of the other pieces that stood out that I thought were, nerve wracking when you see these pieces as part of a compromise, not just getting in data or embedded in the system, but actually having functions or calls or commands to do different things. In particular, what I'm talking about here is the, I believe it was the Footwine module that does a lot of the key logging, but also does screen capture, audio capture, video capture. I was like, I hate seeing those. I don't know if they do that for you, but when I see those, I get a little, a little tinge. But no, you covered this really well, man.
Cool. Yeah, I felt like I had to get a lot in a short period of time.
Well done. Standing ovation.
Perfect. Well, I think that kind of sums up this week's Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast episode. So looking forward to syncing back up next week. So with that, we'll just close out the top threat hunting headlines for the week of March 4th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.